Hello, fellow Earth folks. I'm Annie Gigg, GYG, here on CFRU 93.3 FM and CFRU.ca, available wherever you are in the world. Warm welcome to Better Me, Better World, the show for growth-minded change makers, difference makers, and happiness makers. At the end of the previous episode, I noted that that show's content was particularly heavy, as so it's generally been along the way of the BU journey. The topics of self-discovery, letting go of what's familiar, embracing your shadow side, and the like are pretty weighty. But that doesn't mean that personal development, actualizing your authentic self, is or needs to be a serious matter, although it's a matter to be taken seriously, I strongly believe. I also strongly believe that our journey through life should be fun. And Mother Teresa, who had the very weighty, serious, lifelong work of serving the neediest, poorest people in the world, said, "Life is a game, play it." Game and play suggest fun and levity. If Mother Teresa could hold that attitude, can we not? A while back, I wrote a blog piece called Sudoku, The Game of Life. I'll share that piece here as it provides a segue from the topic of the previous Better Me, Better World episode, which concerned a very challenging period of my life, to this episode's chat about how life is a game to be played and enjoyed. Here goes. I swear it was Sudoku that held me together mentally and emotionally at a time when I was incredibly fragile. Literally, it saved my sanity. And in its various forms, Sudoku, Sumdoku, Wooddoku, it continues to be an oasis of tranquility for me, especially when times are tough, or sometimes when I'm just looking for a great procrastinator tool. But before I get into that, I have to clear up a misconception. I've heard people say they're not interested in Sudoku because they don't like math. Sudoku is not math, unless it's the Sumdoku version, which requires the ability to do additions. Admittedly, the Japanese word Sudoku means single number, and the game might resemble math in that it's logic-based and uses the numerals 1 to 9 in the game board grid, but they're just symbols. The numerals could easily be replaced with 9 letters from the alphabet or, say, 9 astrological symbols, except they'd be awfully hard to draw on the little grid squares. And the game could be called single symbol. Similar to chess, Sudoku's a brain exercising game in that when you're making a move, you have to think a few steps ahead about the implications. Similar to life, it's a game of successive challenges. And when you find your Goldilocks level of Sudoku difficulty, it feels just right. I get that Sudoku may not feel right for everyone, regardless of the difficulty level, just like I generally don't enjoy crossword puzzles, which appeal to many of my family members. But whether or not you're a Sudoku junkie, when you consider the nature of the game, you may come to see it as a tidy little metaphor of life, offering some helpful hints on how to play the big game. First, I'll describe how Sudoku is played. Then I'll share what Sudoku.com says about the traits of people who enjoy playing Sudoku. And finally, I'll offer up my takeaways from the game that are relevant to playing life enjoyably and rewardingly. So, how is Sudoku played? On your computer, tablet or phone, or in a puzzle book, or in a newspaper, if there are still some of those around, you're presented with a Sudoku 9x9 grid comprised of 9 columns, 9 rows, and 9 square subsections. Altogether, there are 81 little squares in the grid, and depending on which form of the game you're playing, some of the squares will contain gratuitous numerals at the outset. The aim of the game is to fill in all the blank squares with the numerals from 1 to 9, with no numeral duplicated in any column, row, or small square section. Generally, but not always, the more numerals the grid is pre-populated with, the easier the game. That's it. Some people like to play competitively, while others to see who can finish the game fastest. Others like to play alone, competing against the clock, Still others, like me, are solitary players without the clock, deriving satisfaction from meeting a challenge in our own time. And what are the traits of Sudoku devotees? According to Sudoku.com, serious Sudoku players characteristically exhibit the following traits: orderly thinking, i.e. a methodical mind, ability to focus, coolness under pressure, determination, ready to recognize opportunities, ability to switch gears, competitive, meditative. All of these traits, I think you'll agree, are likewise useful in the game of life. However, I'm going to elaborate on the meditative trait because this is the one that is most significant for me. Plus, at the opening of this article, I alluded to the salvific importance of Sudoku as a tool to aid my meditation when I most needed it, and I suggested I'd return to it. Sudoku.com elaborates on the meditative aspect, saying, many Sudoku players find that the game gives them a sense of calm. The process of solving Sudoku puzzles tends to be relaxing and even meditative for many people. Some players use Sudoku as a chance to clear their mind and to go into a deep thinking mental state where they seem to become one with the puzzle. It might sound a little woo-woo, but I get it, because I've been there, done that. I can attest to how playing Sudoku can be relaxing and calming and foster meditation. Over the years, I've been immersed in Sudoku games at home, on trains, in airport lounges, pleasantly oblivious to people around me talking and doing whatever they're doing. In circumstances like that, it's really about getting nicely into flow, a state where you're so engrossed in your activity, you're unaware of the passage of time and anything external to your focus. But I've gone much deeper than that with Sudoku. I'm referring to my experience during a hyper-intense period in my life. It was when I became sole caregiver to my adult daughter while she was experiencing a mental health crisis that manifested in its extreme as bipolar mania and psychosis. Having no experience in the area of mental illness and being on my own, I was totally unprepared and unsupported for this suddenly imposed crazy-making life challenge. As I elaborated on in the previous episode, normalcy was swept away and replaced with chaos, sleeplessness, unpredictability, fear of the unknown, and intense anxiety. In the maelstrom, to my huge surprise, I found a place of calm and comfort. It was in playing Sudoku. At the just right level of difficulty, I found that the puzzles demanded all my focused brain power to solve them. By becoming completely mentally enveloped by the logic task at hand, there was no dangling part of my mind that life stressors could grab a hold of. I was temporarily secure from my confused and frightened thinking about my inability to solve the bigger challenges I was facing. That escape into a mentally engrossing but inconsequential task gave me respite, which in hindsight, I believe was crucial to me not going off the deep end. I went through a lot of puzzles. I found out early on that the restorative escape, the tranquility, didn't happen if the puzzle was too easy. Part of my mind was still free to wander because total focus wasn't required. And if the puzzle was too hard, frustration prevented me from finding my way into that place of calm. The Goldilocks puzzle took me to where I needed to go, to be one with it. And Sudoku's relevance to playing life enjoyably and rewardingly is, it's this. Over the years of playing Sudoku, I've found that the game reminds me how to more happily and fulfillingly play life. Here are reminders that serve me well. Life is unending practice. Each grid of Sudoku I complete is practice for the next grid. Each challenge I face in life is practice for the next one. A challenge is an opportunity for learning and growth to be appreciated, not regretted. Life is collecting ahas. It doesn't happen in every Sudoku game, but the excitement of an aha, discovering a new way to solve the puzzle, is visceral. When I find a solution to a Sudoku situation that persistently stumped me, frustrated me, kept me stuck, I feel empowered knowing that that particular situation can no longer stop me in the future. And in the game of life, each aha, each nugget of awareness and understanding that I collect increases my ability to overcome life-sabotaging beliefs, thoughts, and behaviors that have been keeping me stuck. Life is playing at the Goldilocks level of difficulty, and that level is not static. In the beginning, I played Sudoku at the easy level. That's where I needed to be, as I picked up tricks and rules and discovered patterns. For a time, the easy level was motivationally challenging. Then it wasn't. With ongoing practice and collecting of ahas over the years, my just right level of challenge moved from easy to medium to hard to challenger to expert, and here I sit, enjoyably and rewardingly challenged, knowing I'm going to continue to be stymied by a good number of puzzles until I collect more ahas. Some of the expert level games I play remain unsolved for days or even weeks until I'm able to see what I've been missing all along. And so it is with life. When I'm consistently playing below my Goldilocks level, when I'm under-challenged at work, I've no stimulating interests, I'm not engaged in appropriately intense physical or mental workouts, then I'm feeling unmotivated, bored, and unfulfilled. When I'm regularly playing above my Goldilocks level, when work demands are excessive, I'm pursuing too many or too stressful interests, I'm pushing myself too hard mentally and physically, then I'm feeling unmotivated, overwhelmed, and ill. At the Goldilocks level, with just the right amount of stress or challenge, life is motivating, enjoyable, and rewarding. Life is playing alone, one with the game. Even if I were a competitive Sudoku player, online or face-to-face in competitions, I'd always still be playing the grid in front of me by myself. It's a solitary game in the sense of just me and the grid. There may be similarities in the logic or steps that I use to solve the puzzle compared to the process another player of the same puzzle might follow, but in the end, I'll do it my unique way. There are how-to videos on Sudoku solving, and I've integrated helpful expertise from others into my experiential learning. But still, my game is singular, because I am singular. And at its best, it captivates me wholly, so that I'm fully and completely immersed in it. Sudoku reminds me that I'm playing my game of life alone, practicing, making mistakes, learning as I go, incorporating the wisdom of others, enjoyably and rewardingly playing at my evolving Goldilocks level. At its best, in those moments of flow when I'm one with the game, it is an oasis of tranquility. That ends my Sudoku-specific article, but Sudoku is only one type of game that can be considered analogous to life. I was raised on the card game called Euchre. My earliest memories of it are the adults in our house, typically when friends and or relatives had been invited over, being awfully rowdy while playing the game, obviously having a great deal of fun beating or cursing their opponents. And in any family gathering there were, there still are to this day, sure to be at least a couple of tables of euchre players. I was maybe, 9 or 10 when I learned to play and quickly caught the bug. There's no need for me to explain how euchre is played because card games in general are analogous to life. There are quotes to substantiate this claim. Jawaharlal Nehru said, "Life is like a game of cards. The hand you are dealt is determinism. The way you play it is free will." I agree with that simile and could also comfortably replace determinism with fate or luck, i.e. you have no control over the cards that are dealt to you. And I could replace free will with your choosing, i.e. how you play the cards that you are dealt is your choice. Randy Posh likewise said, "We cannot change the cards we are dealt, just how we play the game." I believe to some degree or other, influenced by nature and nurture, our DNA and life experiences, we all have the capacity to change how we play the game of life. And Voltaire said it this way, "Each player must accept the cards life deals him or her, but once they are in hand, he or she alone must decide how to play the cards in order to win the game." To my thinking, to win the game of life means to live fully, authentically, peacefully, and purposefully. In light of the cards of life that we're holding, which are different for each and every individual, we can choose how to respond to any life circumstance, how we play our cards. It's the nature of life, however, that some people will be dealt better or worse cards than you, i.e. have greater or lesser privileges and opportunities than do you by virtue of nature and nurture. This is where the card game analogy doesn't fit exactly with the game of life. In a card game, you are competing against the opposing team. In the game of life, you're only competing with yourself, so to speak. Says Michael Arteta, the challenge is how to be better than the day before, than the previous game. Because each player is dealt different cards over which the player has no say in receiving, we, the players, can never, ever compare ourselves to others. For one example, our physical attractiveness is one sort of card that we're dealt. In a Nevada Today article, Kristen Gruse references a book called Beauty Pays, written by economist David Hammermesh. The book shows, and I quote, that attractive people are more likely to be employed, are paid higher wages, are more likely to be approved for a loan, negotiate loans with better terms, and have better looking and higher status spouses. Attractive criminals even receive lighter sentences for their crimes. And occasionally their mugshots go viral and they end up with fan clubs and modeling contracts. Google hot convict for that story. End of quote. Whether we're holding an ace or a lowly two card with regard to our physical experience, at least according to how physical beauty is judged by society, it's up to us to play that card in the very best way we can. That's the happy part of the life is a card game analogy. We can always choose how to play the card we're dealt, whether it's an ace or a two. The intent of the BU journey is to empower cardholders to make the best decisions in playing their cards. Speaking of empowerment, the late Christopher Reeve, Superman actor, is a powerful, inspirational manifestation of choosing how to play the cards you're dealt. At the age of 43, when the horse he was riding suddenly stopped, Reeve was projected forward, entangled in the reins, landing head first on the ground and shattering his first and second vertebrae. The spinal injury permanently paralyzed him from the neck down and halted his breathing. And what did he have to say about this devastating, life-altering experience? I quote, "Who knows why an accident happens? The key is what do you do afterwards? There is a period of shock and then grieving with confusion and loss. After that, you have two choices. One is to stare out the window and gradually disintegrate. And the other is to mobilize and use all your resources, whatever they may be, to do something positive. That's the road I've taken. It comes naturally to me. I am a competitive person, and right now I'm competing against decay. I don't want osteoporosis or muscle atrophy or depression to beat me." End of quote. Despite his hugely constrained lifestyle after the accident, Reeve said, "You play the hand you're dealt. I think the game's worthwhile." But if you're not a card player, the life is a game analogy doesn't end with card games either. Do you like chess? I don't know how to play the game myself. It's on my to-learn list. But an unknown author enlightened me somewhat by saying, "No one has ever won a game of chess by only taking forward moves. Sometimes you have to move backwards to take better steps forward. That's life." I do know about the "that's life" part. I've said elsewhere, speaking from personal experiences, some of life's most important messages are in our biggest mess-ups. So we take the step backward when we're messing up, but we can take advantage of better forward steps if we are open to hearing the message in the mess up, instead of squandering the growth opportunity in blame or victimhood or self-flagellation. As Alice Cooper said, "Mistakes are part of the game. It's how well you recover from them. That's the mark of a great player." In this vein, Don Yeager recounted what Michael Jordan taught him after they had a game of one-on-one. "A loss is not a failure until you make an excuse. When excuses are no longer an option, you can focus your attention on the job you have to do and not why it didn't get done." Staying with Jordan, he said, I've missed more than 9,000 shots in my career. I've lost almost 300 games. 26 times I've been trusted to take the winning game shot and missed. I've failed over and over and over again in my life, and that is why I succeed. Aaron Judge has a similar take on failure, saying, to a certain extent, I enjoy failure. It's part of the game. There's always room to grow. There's room to improve. And a failure or multiple failures or mistakes never defines the person that you are. I like how Doug Peterson says it. Everybody is going to have a bad game. One game does not decide somebody's season. And with Michael Jordan as proof of this, multiple missed shots don't make a player a failure. Recovering from and learning from a mistake or failure is the mark of a great player, as Cooper said. Another mark of greatness is putting your all into the game. Half-ass efforts produce half-ass results in games on the court and in the game of life. Walter Cronkite, to this point, said, I can't imagine a person becoming a success who doesn't give the game of life everything they've got. And returning to Michael Jordan yet again, these are his words. Be true to the game, because the game will be true to you. If you try to shortcut the game, then the game will shortcut you. If you put forth the effort, good things will be bestowed upon you. That's truly about the game, and in some ways, about life too. Elsewhere, he said, the game has its ups and downs, but you can never lose focus of your individual goals, and you can't let yourself be beat because of lack of effort. Indeed, I've come to understand that we do get out of life exactly what we put into it, even if it may not seem so when we're in the downs that Jordan mentions. So another happy aspect of living life as a game is that, here again, we have the choice about how much effort we want to make, and therefore how many rewards we want to gain. The effectiveness of our efforts is greatly enhanced when we invest in self-awareness and personal development so as to become increasingly un-effwithable. And to make that investment mean, you have to get down off the bleachers and on to the playing field. No one is going to do it for you. If you're not in the game, you can't hit a home run, said David Hasselhoff. Going back to the chess game analogy, to say it another way, you can either be a pawn in life, moved about the game board with no say in the matter of where you go, or you can be the player making the moves. And to add to the analogies of life being a game of Sudoku or chess or cards or basketball or whatever other game, I'm going to make one more game analogy here before wrapping up this chat in order to share a final aspect of gaming that translates nicely to the game of life. As much as I enjoy Sudoku, more recently I've also come to enjoy online Scrabble, competing with the computer using an app called Funky Potato. I most particularly enjoy playing Scrabble on a real Scrabble board with my real-life mom and sisters at a real table, but when I don't have that opportunity, the computer is a reasonably satisfying virtual substitute. If you're not familiar with the game, it's slightly akin to doing crosswords, which ironically you may recall me saying I don't particularly enjoy, but the comparison is limited to both games requiring that words be played either horizontally or vertically on a grid, with the words necessarily connecting by a letter to a word already on the grid. Similar to a card game where the player is dealt cards they have no choice about receiving, but does have a choice in how to play those cards, the Scrabble player blindly picks letter tiles, meaning the player has no say in what tiles they get, but they can choose how to play those letters on the board to form words. Each played letter yields a certain number of points, and the goal is for the player to maximize the points gained in the placement of words. Also, similar to the game of Sudoku, in virtual Scrabble, the player has the ability to select the level of difficulty at which they want to play. Here again, when playing at my Goldilocks level, this game is fun, relaxing, and challenging, the very experiences I want in the game of life. The other thing I alluded to that I get out of this game is the very helpful reminder to not sweat a missed opportunity, because that miss can translate into an even greater opportunity further along. For example, in a recent virtual Scrabble game, after I placed my word on the board, too late, I realized I could have earned several extra points by using my letter P to make an even better word. It was a close game, nearing the end, with the computer and me neck and neck, and I cursed what could have been my mistake that gave the computer the win. As the game goes, I picked up new letter tiles to replace the number of tiles I'd put on the board in my last turn. Excitingly, using the P I'd missed playing in my previous turn, I could now use it in combination with the new letters I picked to make an awesome word that got me so many points in my next turn that there was no way for the computer could catch up with me. That, my friends, is my reminder to replace regret about a missed opportunity with anticipation that miss could potentially lead to a benefit that cannot be foreseen in the present moment. Yes, I could have just as easily lost that game by not playing the P in my previous turn if I'd picked up different letters than I did, with which the P couldn't be used for my next turn. But my thinking is, it feels so much better to replace regret with anticipation, so why the hell not? Isn't that a happier way to be regardless of the way the game may ultimately unfold? Is there anything to lose other than unhappy negativity? This episode has unfolded to its close, and I want to leave you with one last game quote, this one by Mike Singletary, who said, "Do you know what my favorite part of the game is? The opportunity to play." I invite you to tune in to the next episode of Better Me, Better World. I'll be back same time next week, same place here at CFRU 93.3 FM or CFRU.ca. The shows are recorded, so alternatively, have a listen when it works best for you. Until next time, be you. I'm Annie Gigg.